program.
Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting to order of the Work Group on Regional Education Delivery Systems. Want to welcome and thank everyone for joining us this morning. In terms of the agenda, we're going to have the committee here talk a little bit about future meetings. We're going to then open up an informational hearing. We will hear from various parties regarding student health care models, and just know that from my point of view, I'm looking for what are those things that enhance the working together of the various organizations for student access to health care, and what are those things that are barriers in the way of getting greater access for student health care in terms of processes, in terms of how things are financed and funded and billed, those kinds of things. So I'm hoping that we can hear some of that information. Following that, we will continue our discussion regarding potential legislation on incentive-based cooperatives for non-instructional expenses. And I think that'll fill up our time quite well. So, colleagues, I want to start with, we don't have a meeting scheduled at this point beyond today, and I'm thinking that we'd like to have one scheduled. I don't know whether you want to do that now or whether you want me to throw out some dates later electronically, but if we have our calendars, are you interested in setting a date now?
Sure.
Okay. So someone go ahead and recommend a date out there.
Jim, are you thinking November? Is that like a month out, or?
Yeah, I'm thinking I don't know whether we're going to need one more or two more to meet our November 20th deadline that we had set for ourselves. If we do need two more, I'm thinking that maybe we can do one right near the end of October, and then another one, you know, right near the beginning, just like we did these two that were pretty close together.
What about the 29th of October?
The 29th of October.
You set a date. I'm throwing it out.
How's that look for people?
I could do the afternoon, not the morning.
What date was that?
29th.
Wednesday. I can't do it.
Okay. 27th?
I could do the 28th, but not anything later in the week.
And the 27th, you could, Lori, or not?
Yes, I could do the 27th.
Okay, so the 27th is out there. What do we think? Does that work for everyone?
The 27th, if it's from like 1 to 3, something like that.
We could just make it be that. One representative? We
apologize.
No problem. We are looking.
Vice President's problem, traffic.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
My excuse. I'm sticking with it.
You know what? It's a good one and it works.
Thank you. I apologize.
We're looking right now at a possible date to meet next, and we're looking at October 27th in the afternoon, if that works. We're looking at 1 to 3. If that works for everybody, we're gonna make it happen.
Shoot. Well, I needed to be in Salem in the morning, Eugene at noon, and I'd have to come back. The 28th is more open for me, but that wasn't gonna work. Is that right?
Yeah, but we can look at something else. Like,
28th is fine.
The 28th is fine.
Oh, the 28th was fine?
28th is okay.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I heard someone say the 28th.
I'm just throwing out dates. You said dates.
No, that's right. We appreciate it. Get the show on the road here. So the 28th, and you the preference would be what time? Does it matter for anybody?
1 to 3 is good.
1 to 3? Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. October 28th from 1 to 3 will be our next meeting. I want to write that down before I forget. Okay. Thank you so much. All right. I'm going to open an informational hearing on regional education delivery systems through Senate Bill 1525. We have several parties who have graciously given of their time to come this morning and provide some information for the team. However you want to organize this, if some of you want to go together, but I'll just start bringing people forward and you can collect together if you'd like. But we're going to start with Multnomah ESD coming forward. Margo is here, and please remember to introduce yourself, tell us who you are, where you're from for the record, and then you're welcome to begin. Welcome.
Good morning. Margo Lawlich, Director of Schoolhouse Services, Multnomah ESD. I don't have a formal presentation for you today. I'm here really to answer additional questions you may have and regarding activities since our last meetings and correspondence with this with the task force.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Can you outline for us how the funding flows?
For school nursing
services, for all the healthcare services you may provide?
So I will speak specifically. I have some background in school-based health centers, but I'll speak specifically for school nursing. School nursing is primarily somewhere between 90-95% funded with state school fund dollars in the state of Oregon. That's pretty accurate across the country, actually. We know that from the National Association of School Nursing data, as well as looking at our own data in Oregon. Additionally, we did a sample survey that we presented that data to you the last time we met, looking at where funding is coming from, a sample of large, medium, and knowing small districts. And so it's primarily state school fund. And then there are also eligible services for which, in a school setting, we can bill Medicaid. And the degree to which districts bill Medicaid varies across the state. I'm in the process of getting some of that data right now, and they're actually building a report for me. I can't get it specifically district by district or school by school because of confidentiality reasons, because of the populations, but I will be able to get that county by county in the next couple of weeks. What we do in Multnomah County is we bill Medicaid for all the procedures, codes that we can, and the districts bill Medicaid directly for delegated services. The districts are paid directly as well for those services rendered for the delegated services, and we credit back school districts those Medicaid dollars. So and typically that's on the contracting side because our funding is both resolution and contracts, and those contracts are more specifically for students who are either medically fragile, medically complex, or require one-to-one nursing, or maybe are on a 504. And so when we get those Medicaid dollars, we credit back the district and it offsets what they would pay in state school funds.
Is that Medicaid? Are you billing DHS or OHA?
DHS.
That's what I thought.
Yes. Okay. And it's federal. There's a match that we have to pay as well under IDEA.
That's still not right into the CCO.
No, it's not at all.
That's out of that small pot, or actually large pot of Medicaid that's still in DHS that we haven't figured out how to deal with yet.
And these are qualifying services that across the country districts are able to specifically bill for. And you had asked a previous question about why we're not billing for more, and it relates to the free care rule, and there is work going on federally with that happening. And actually in July a memo came out from the Department of Health and Human Services that they're having conversations. But the free care rule basically says that if you're providing services to one student, you have to provide it to all students, and therefore you can't single it out and get reimbursement. And so it's really, in principle, it's good. It's about equity. So we can take that equity and go either direction with it. So there's work being done on it, and it's really, that's a federal policy change. That's not something Oregon could weigh in on that, but it's federal policy.
So you're saying poverty children are not treated differently from middle-income children, because that all children are supposed to be treated equally. Is that what you're saying?
In a school setting. So therefore, as it relates specifically to school nursing, because the service delivery for school-based health centers is different, is that when a district employs or contracts for school nursing, that school nurse has the responsibility of serving all children in that school district. Now, the reality of that is you serve the students that you're able to see for the hours that you're assigned to a particular school, because school nurses often can be assigned anywhere from 3 to 7 schools and thousands of students, in addition to the students with very specific health needs that gets into the whole delegation and complex and fragile healthcare needs.
We have Tricia and then Representative.
Where is the regulatory barrier to billing third-party, I don't know what you call them, insurance companies? Is there a prohibition in federal law, or is there something in state law, or is it just that we don't do that?
Well, the prohibition would be the free care rule in terms of the federal government paying, reimbursing the delivery of school nursing services in schools. That does not prevent, for example, Oregon, under its health transformation model, to look at how we're reimbursing care that's being delivered in any setting, whether we do it, for example, the way some of programs in the state of Oregon are funded for public health, in the way they look at sort of a baseline funding, and then it may be then additional funding may be allocated on a per capita basis. So in a school setting, it would look at all districts across the state would get a base funding, and then we look at that population, the number of students, almost like we do ADMW, correct? And say each district is going to get an additional allocation of dollars, and that's to support the delivery of health services. What those services would be is part of this conversation. That's one example. And then other ways are making it a third-party billing. That comes with its own challenges as well, in addition to, you know, just sort of the bureaucratic process of that versus doing some type of, you know, grant-funded allocation.
So there's no actual prohibition other than it's maybe cumbersome. We don't have anybody in place to
do
it.
We don't have a system.
Sort of thing.
We have the infrastructure. We just don't have the system in place, and in fact, we haven't even had that conversation yet. So, but no, there's no prohibition that I'm aware of in Oregon. I think we could actually be a leader in that, honestly.
Representative Nathanson.
Well, I think what you've seen is we have started that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
This work group.
Yes.
And thank you to Tricia Smith in particular, but this work group has said we're going to start that conversation now. There are two things I want to ask about. We understand about the problems of helping take care of children with very special needs.
Mm-hmm.
What about the delivery of health care that does affect absenteeism, taking care of all the kids, whether they're Medicaid or not Medicaid, who come to school and they have a toothache, they have an earache, they have a sore throat. There's a lot of stuff that causes kids to be unable to pay attention in school. There may be no one at home to take care of them, and maybe that's why they're at school, but they shouldn't be at school. And in some cases, those toothaches or earaches or sore throats turn into something even worse. So please describe a scenario where we could better fund just the delivery of routine health care in schools. Kids need help, and someone needs to help them. How describe some way we can do that, other than just talking about this special needs kid gets individual special funding.
Right. From the system's perspective. So this is where I would say in most areas, regardless of who you talk to in the delivery of health services, which is one component of that whole child, whole community, whole school model, is having a presence there every day in the school, whether it's a school-based health center or it's a school nurse on a consistent basis to respond to the health needs and health issues that arise for students. Because the way it currently exists, you know, we only have so many school-based health centers, and they have their capacity, and they're not there 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, or for that whole school. We have nurses who are in schools, they have 3 to 5 schools. So they may be in a school 3 hours a day, they may be in a school 1 day a week, or 2 days a week. So when they're not present in the school, those same issues go to the school secretary, who is making decisions about whether or not that student stays in school or calls the parent or goes back to class. We all capture that data, but it's very fragmented because we are not present on a consistent basis throughout the system. So that's one piece of it. The second, I think we would all agree, is that we've done a good job in terms of building access as it relates to coverage for students, so that universal coverage for children under Medicaid. We still have definitely a population that is not covered. So there's more access to a primary care home, dental, anywhere a child goes. I mean, the immunizations are accessible and available in the state of Oregon with or without insurance. So it's really assisting families in how to, one, navigate that system. So we have the community health worker, and there's work going on in piloting actually community education workers. And we're working actually with Multnomah Early Childhood right now to implement that model and see how that works. So that's a piece of it, is the navigation, and then those barriers that affect families from accessing their medical homes. So there's that piece of it. And then I think that the third is how we support each other in a complementary way in the delivery of health services in the schools. With that being said, right now in school nursing, we're responsible for the whole population because we work on behalf of the school districts. For that 3 to 21 population, regardless of what their health needs are. So we have, like I said, kids on ventilators, kids with controlled or uncontrolled seizures, diabetics, we can go down the list, kids on insulin pumps, kids on ongoing infusions for other health reasons who require monitoring. The way the system is set up right now is school-based health centers serve their population as a primary care home. So a student goes, makes an appointment, gets their services, and it may become their medical home. But the system isn't set up that requires them with their funding, regardless of who it's coming from, to provide clinical backup and support to the delivery of health services in the schools. So that's a barrier. If the school nurse can't take care of that student, we delegate that to a secretary, a teacher, an educational assistant, even though we have school-based health centers that have mid-level practitioners, have medical assistants, may or may not have a nurse. Usually they're not staffed with nurses in every school-based health center. One way that we can really work together to support the student population is to look at what services are being delivered. And if it's a primary care home, why is it not providing that clinical support and backup to students, even if it means building their capacity? Because as we build more school-based health centers, why not say part of the criteria is to provide that clinical support to kids so that they can stay in school, even if they're not an established patient? So that's a bigger conversation, but I really believe it's a missed opportunity. Why are we delegating to secretaries to manage seizures and give rectal diastat and blood sugars? We have secretaries giving insulin when we have school-based health centers that have trained staff who could be administering insulin or managing other issues for these students.
I want to understand exactly what you're saying, though. I get what you say needs to happen. What's preventing the school-based health centers from doing that right now?
Well, I can't speak for all the school-based health centers. I think part of, and they'll speak for themselves and answer it, but I think part of it is what's the original origin of school-based health centers and what their criteria is. They have to meet certain requirements in order to be a certified school-based health center. Many are certified primary care homes, which is great. Oregon has very high standards for school-based health centers, but it's really not written into their requirements. It hasn't even been a conversation up to this point in time. There's been, a very distinct line between what the school-based health center does and what school nursing does, and I think that there, when we're talking about health transformation and stewardship of our health dollars and certainly the care of our students, keeping them in school, keeping them safe and healthy in school, it's a worthwhile investment for everyone to really look at. If we're building the capacity of both and we're looking at a balanced funding formula, let's also look at sharing that the support for the all the health needs of students in the schools, not just for some.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I really appreciate your testimony on this. It reminds me, you know, the conversation about the free care rule and equity and access being words and values that we all have, and yet it reminds me of Anatole France's remarks about democracy being that rich and poor alike are prohibited from sleeping on park benches. It doesn't particularly achieve our goal if we aren't...
Right.
If we aren't blending our mission so that the bottom line is service to kids, yep. however we find them, wherever and whenever we find them, and radical as the notion might be, it seems like one of the best things this regional task force could do legislatively is figure out a way to blend those services under one statute so that, first of all, kids are served, and secondly, that... we find a way to include the third-party billing piece everywhere, which means that there are more resources on the table so that this isn't a pie-in-the-sky notion.
Other questions for Margo?
I would offer just to let you know that we're having many robust conversations, and there is we have not encountered any entity, association, otherwise that is opposed to looking really at this systematically. There's resounding support for this because it's about the whole population. And these students, we serve 3 to 21, are going to be our adults one day, and so we want to take care of them now, and they're in school 6 hours a day.
Doug?
Under your definition of school health services, does that include mental health services?
Absolutely, and I think school nursing, our role in the sort of the support of mental and behavioral health, unless the student is specifically on an IEP in which the nurse is involved, is that, you know, we get all the health room visits, the nurse triages that and refers to the school counselor, the school psychologist, and the school-based health center. And school-based health centers are doing excellent work in building their capacity to provide more and more mental health services. It's much needed. We all know that. In surveying our own school nurses in Multnomah County, and we have over half of the school nurses in the state, it was their number one priority when they said, when I asked, what are your top three priorities? We need more help for mental health. So there's more the nurse can do as sort of the triage and that gatekeeper, in a sense. But as a whole, absolutely.
Just a heads up for you and for those who are going to follow, because we've had conversations about this, and Representative Nathanson and I had a meeting during Ledge Days with Senator Mona Sanderson, and I have got legislation drafted. Basically, all it is, we made sure we had the right relating clauses. but we want to move this thing, and we're very serious about it. So we're going to need all the help we can get on making the transition appropriately. But the legislation is pre-session filed, so.
Great. Excellent.
Sure. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, to all committee members and the Chair, I apologize. Senator Cruz, I guess for you, what I'm hearing from the conversation and the meetings that we've had, this health care issue, I think I'm seeing a change from the Department of Education as far as, you know, involvement and everything. But if I'm not mistaken, there is no directives or statutes right now about nurses. It's a manual for nurses, school nurses. Is that correct? Is there any laws that says what school nurses do or what? I don't think there is. What I'm hoping from Senator Cruz, maybe, I think, is we need to decide what is our mission. First, decide the mission, and then figure out how to accomplish that mission as far as health care for children. You know, we're going through a reformation now from the governor of early learning councils and CCOs. I'm concerned. I'm working a bill on the side that we have another education task force looking at the school distribution formula. And I don't want to make Senator Devlin upset, but I think that committee has, again, punted the ball, kicked the can down the road on the distribution formula. I've introduced and working with ODE on some legislation, because there's $180 million every school budget that's set aside for low income. And to me, low income also would be health, mm-hmm. but not just, you know, more books or something like that. So. First of all, we need to define the mission. What are we going to do now as far as it's not just reading? Are we to read, you got to be healthy. You know, I'm proud of my work on a bill about the vision. You know, you got to be able to see, but you also got to be at school and have health to be there and everything. So I think, and I know, Jeff, or, you know, how your bill or Nancy's, your bill as far as we need to decide now what the state, what is the government and the education system, what do we want to provide? And then see how we can do that and fund it appropriately.
So if I could respond to your comment about the mandates and standards for school nursing, because in our proposing our legislative concept, that one of the four asks related to that. So there is no mandate for school nursing in the state of Oregon, and for most states west of the Mississippi. East of the Mississippi, the language looks different, but it's legislatively mandated for the most part. There are national standards for, as well as certification for school nurses. Oregon does not require that. Oregon has no system in place, which was one of our second asks for the infrastructure systems piece, to measure any health outcomes related to the delivery of services, impact on health status of students. So the data we actually do capture, even if it's related to the what we do capture in school health services, is actually very limited data, because no one is capturing it for the school age population across the state of Oregon for the delivery of care that school nurses are providing. Because school nursing has not been part of the office or the program in the public health division that really targets school and adolescent health, that's primarily, it's focused on a number of programs in addition to school-based health centers. And in the bill that sort of gave direction to the requirements for the proposals for the development of incoming school-based health centers, and looking at who the list of required sort of partnering in the development of that, school nursing, curiously, is actually not listed as one of those partners. So I think it's not anybody's fault. This is not to point fingers at anybody. I think what we're doing here is highlighting that there's this void or vortex in the system that actually is really important, has made an impact, and if we work together as a system, can make a greater impact. So we do need to have nursing mandated, and nursing was part of public health. And public health is mandated in the state of Oregon, but about 30 years ago, it was moved out of public health, and I don't think anyone thought about the fact that it loses that protection.
Representative Nathan.
I'll add a quick question, which those of you who follow Ways and Means hearings will recognize what kind of question this is. So we're spending money on something, but we must not have any performance measures, or we don't track activity data. So we spend not just thousands, but probably millions of dollars on something, and we don't know how much of a service we're delivering to how many people. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And when we presented our initial legislative concept to you, and when we were having our own internal conversations, and I wear my public health with that, a health hat with that, having come from that area specifically, that was it, is how can we be investing in this, and we have no way of evaluation. And again, that was part of the proposal of folding this into the Oregon Health Authority, is because they do have the infrastructure in place for doing that. And this is just one piece of it. It's not building a new system. The system already exists. It's just being more inclusive. A huge investment on behalf of Oregon into the health of our student population.
And can I follow up?
Sure.
One other sort of data nerd question. You mentioned that you can provide information by county, but not by school or district, mm-hmm. because of privacy concerns.
Mm-hmm.
I need to hear more about that, because it's certainly easy to hide or obscure information about an individual person, but still collect
right.
or collect aggregated data on how many people were being treated for what kind of thing. So I don't understand
that
why
data.
We yeah. can't get information by school district, for example.
So this is what I actually was just sent some reports last week from the two Medicaid analysts who are work with ODE. Thank you. I thought you might ask this question. So so I asked for two sets of data, and this is gets back to actually your comment, is they're building reports now, and what that for me, because I'm asking the questions that you're asking, because and if they're building the reports, it means nobody's been asking that question previously, at least recently. So one of the reports that they sent me for the last 3 years is was aggregated data, which I'm happy to forward to you, on billable procedures by discipline. It's a report that does exist that they give to ODE, so just aggregated data for the whole state. And I got about 3 or 4 years of that data. So we're looking at occupational therapy, physical therapy, nursing services, that which is billable. What I had said in my conversation with them last week is I want specifically billable procedures for nursing services delivered, including delegated care, because they're two different things. The delegated care, remember, is the care that's being delivered by educational assistants, secretaries, teachers, whoever's getting assigned to do that by the district or the school. And I asked for it by district and by school, and they said it would be difficult to do it by school because in many of our smaller districts and communities, there may be one student that's billable, and so it would be difficult to maintain that sort of protection. And I said, can you at least give it to me by county? And they said, yes, we can do that by county. So they're actually mapping it right now, and had just Friday I got an email about the modifiers for that. And I thought, oh, it's going to take months to get this. And she said, no, it'd actually take a couple weeks. So that's a good start.
And treating a student for an earache is not billable?
Not if they come to the school nurse, it's not billable. If they come to a school-based health center, and I'll let them answer that specifically, but I do have some experience with school-based health centers and on the public health side of my life, is that if they come in as a patient and it's an office visit, then that becomes a billable visit based upon what their insurance would be. And then throughout the state, it looks different how that school-based health center is set up, of whether or not they see all children regardless of their ability to pay.
I'd like to follow up.
Sure.
So an earache really isn't an earache. if you have it over at this school here, but it does count as an earache if you happen to be over here where there's a school-based health center. This is something I'd like
to... This is our health care system, so not to target school-based health centers. This is our health system.
Oh, right.
So if they go to the secretary,
right,
it may be an earache, or it may be interpreted as a student who doesn't want to be in class, or
maybe
a variety
a nurse
of things.
Saw the student, though.
Right. So I'm saying, but they may, if the nurse isn't there, they're going to go to the secretary.
Right.
So the secretary may, depending upon, decide, okay, we should call the parent or we should send the child back to school. If the nurse is there, the nurse will take the otoscope, look in their ear, do a full nursing assessment. Some of our nurses are nurse practitioners as well, but they don't practice as that in the school setting because they're hired as a school nurse. But they'll look at that, and if there's a school-based health center and there's permission to refer that student to the school-based health center, they will refer that student to the school-based health center if one is accessible. Otherwise, after assessing and looking in their ear, document it, they then call the parent and report the symptoms and say, yeah, this looks like a serious ear infection. And then the parent or guardian or whomever would pick up the child and either take them to the school-based health center or take them to their medical home, which the way the larger health system is designed is we want everyone to have a medical home. So do they go to their medical home, or do they go to the school-based health center? And that decision is left up to them because we now have two potential medical homes.
But even if they've gone to the school nurse and the school nurse has done the exam as you described, mm-hmm, and then they're referred to the school-based health center and they go there,
the part
that the school nurse did is not billable.
No, not at all.
Right, and that's what...
No, education pays for that.
Mr.
Right,
Chair.
Exactly. Tricia.
And for the school secretary or educational assistant that's providing medical services, it may not even be recorded. They're not, as far as I know, and tell me if I'm wrong, as far as I know, for most medical procedures that my classified school, mm-hmm, employees are performing today, there's no requirement that they record what they've done or what the situation is. So no one would even know.
The only time there's documentation of that student and any health-related issues are if a school nurse is in the building because under their licensure and, of course, their training, there's a very specific way they document clinically, and it goes into their health record, and we're now documenting electronically. And, of course, the clinic has its own documentation system as well. If the school nurse is not there, there's absolutely no documentation. So, again, the data that we collect, and we just sent another survey out, a very good survey actually to all the school nurses, and we should probably have that data in about a week. I'm happy to make it available to all of you. The data we're collecting on the status of school health and our true impact on absenteeism and so on and so forth is actually very limited because we only capture that data in Oregon when a student is seen in a school-based health center or a student is seen by a school nurse. And if the district is capturing that data, because while the school nurse is documenting for liability, licensure, documentation, nobody's tracking how many visits a student makes to the school nurse in a school setting. Oregon's never collected that data. We're trying to, and we do in our program because we're so large, but the state is not collecting, nor has ODE ever collected that data. It collects nurse ratio data, and the newest report came out, and I think the questions will be changed a little bit the next survey, but it's skewed because they still lump the one-to-one nurses in with the whole student population, so it looks like the ratio is about 1 to, I think, 2,200. It's actually still about 1 to 4,000 in Oregon, so we're like really, we're down. We're meeting the requirements, but the other we haven't moved.
Well, you have provided the exact type of information that we're looking for,
mm-hmm,
and we appreciate that. We hope that you stick around here in case we have more questions of you.
Mm-hmm.
But in the interest of time, I think you've mentioned others, and I think we'll have those others
absolutely
come forward.
I have one.
You do have one
question
more. Okay.
I'd like to ask because it's related to school-based health centers. Mm-hmm. So,
do you want to ask me, or do you want to ask the school-based health centers?
Yeah, because they're here.
Maybe.
I don't want to speak
both
in their behalf. I can speak of how we work together.
Well,
yeah.
This sounds kind of
we're very mutually
off the wall,
supportive
but
of one another.
Why not?
Just
we're
want you
supposed
to all know
to
that.
Think outside the box here.
That's right.
So there's a rule that you can bill if you've seen someone identified with a school-based health center. Can't bill if it's not. What's to prevent us from setting up 198 shell school-based health centers that exist on paper as an SBHC, and therefore these procedures and ongoing care becomes billable and we can take care of it through the healthcare community? If we have to get around some kind of a rule, why can't we just say, oh, all of a sudden we have tons of SBHCs?
Well, I
and we just have a we define a new tier of school-based health center.
That's a better way, and you know it.
Well, I mean, that's I think point three of the four
takes your breath away.
Well, no, it's the funding. It's
legal?
The funding formula.
Oh, that little thing.
Just but first, we have to look at how we haven't even mapped out how much is going as a whole into the delivery of schoolhouse services, and where is that funding coming from? I mean, we can give that to you. But so I think that's the first question. And then the next question is, why is it coming from them? What are we doing with it separately? And then where does that integrate? Because ultimately, we want to meet that triple aim, right? And we're both doing it. But we're doing it separately because there hasn't been the support. There hasn't been the information, the inquiry. I say the inquiry first, and the information and the recognition that this is very integral to a successful implementation of health transformation in Oregon and to supporting a healthier adult population. So the billing side, again, school-based health centers, their business models are different around the state as they are around the country. Whether or not they can bill insurance is different. It's not consistent. And they can certainly, the state can speak to that more specifically. I know from, so it's great questions. Thanks for asking them.
So we're going to have, thank you, Margo. We're going to have others come forward with the CCOs and the school-based health centers, Oregon Health Authority. So Don Ross, Jessica Duke, come forward, please. And we are very anxious to hear from you. And you've heard the past report, and obviously there's interests of the committee here on expanding access to students, expanding billing, that kind of thing. So we're hoping you can address some of those concerns in your presentation. So welcome, and be sure to introduce yourselves.
And excuse me, this is Muriel, and I'll, when they're finished, I'll add the piece about kind of the local school-based health center piece.
Great. Thank you, Muriel.
Good morning, and thanks very much for having us here. Before I begin, I want to let you know that while I'm not contagious, I am getting over a cold, so bear with the voice that may squeak in and out. Mr. Ross moved.
As long as it's not Ebola, I think we're okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks very much for inviting us here, and we really want to mention that we appreciate that a work group on education really is considering health and how important it is to education. They're intricately intertwined. Better health equals better education. Better education equals better health outcomes. So we really appreciate
you. Can you please state your name and
I'm getting there.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, we just really appreciate you recognizing that. And I am Jessica Duke. I am the Program Manager of Adolescent and School Health at the Oregon Public Health Division, which is part of the Oregon Health Authority. And with me today, an Oregon Health Authority colleague.
Hi, good morning. I'm Don Ross, and I manage the Policy and Planning Section for the Medicaid programs, medical assistance programs in the Oregon Health Authority.
And Don will be here mostly to answer questions as it relates to Medicaid. We did make a presentation for you, and this may be going back a little bit big picture for you just to describe the school-based health center's model and our state program office, and then we'll be happy to answer questions as we're able. So school-based health centers are medical clinics that offer primary care services either within or on school grounds. They provide easy access to health care to reduce barriers such as cost, transportation, and concerns around confidentiality. They provide high-quality physical, mental, and preventive health services to students regardless of their ability to pay. And they really support the educational mission by helping keep kids in school and addressing health-related barriers to learning. So what you see on the slide here is just a snapshot of school-based health services. This is not a complete list, but it's a more typical list of what they do and then who provides those services. So again, routine sort of primary care, routine physicals. Perhaps a unique role of school-based health centers versus a regular primary care office anyway is that they really do try and interconnect and intertwine with the school community. They really do emphasize health prevention messages with the students as they're getting their services in the clinic setting. And they also do presentations in health classrooms and work with the school administration around health issues that may pop up. So that's something unique that they provide that a primary care clinic that's not on school grounds would not provide. All school-based health centers are required to have a primary care provider, either a medical doctor, a nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant, and one support staff. What that looks like in each school-based health center is going to be a little bit different. There are a lot of other staff that can be at school-based health centers. The model is really unique to the center, the school, the community, and that is a part of the model that we really value, that how they're staffed, well, we have some minimum staffing requirements, how they're staffed, how they meet their required hours is going to vary from center to center based on their community resources and needs. So school-based health centers in Oregon are definitely part of the medical delivery system. We just recently became something that is codified in statute. So the statute and the administrative rules numbers that relate to school-based health centers are there. School-based health centers are not in every school in the state, but we do have 68 certified school-based health centers in 20 counties. There is no requirement that a school-based health center be certified. We do certify school-based health centers, and that certification allows our office to provide them technical assistance and support, and then also offers state money. If they're not certified, they're not able to draw down state money from our office. We have 10 communities in 9 counties with school-based health center planning grants. The planning grant process is really a 1 or 2 year process, with our office providing a lot of support to communities to decide if the school-based health center model is something that will work in their community. Most of our school-based health centers are sponsored by a federally qualified health center. Many are sponsored by local public health authorities, some of those being FQHC certified. And 43%, so almost half, we're really proud of this, of our school-based health centers are recognized as patient-centered primary care homes, and almost all use electronic health records.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
go ahead. You heard Representative Nathanson's comment about that's just school-based health clinics. What if we included nurses and called nurses school-based health clinics? What would that do to our numbers? So we could charge the feds for it?
That's a great question. I'm afraid that I'm not able to answer that right here and right now. It's something that certainly we can look at, and it sounds to me like there are maybe some billing considerations around how school nurses bill that we need to look at. I am not aware of anything that would preclude a school nurse from billing for certain services. School nurses are not in my purview, and school-based health centers are. So we have set up a system where school-based health centers can bill for services.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, but ORS 413-225, does that say it has to be 3 people, 2 people?
It does. It says that it has to have certification requirements that we set at our office, and those certification requirements specify.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yeah.
So we could change those numbers. The legislature could.
Certainly.
Okay.
Yeah. Laws can be changed. Absolutely. So just to reiterate, those school nursing services is under the purview of the Oregon Department of Education, not Oregon Health Authority. And so my ability to speak to that is going to be very limited.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Were you present or participating in the legislation, the development of the legislation that you referred to? Do you know whether or not there was discussion about including school-based nurses?
I was not present at that time, so I cannot speak to that. All right. Carry on.
Go ahead.
I just want to let you know that in total, in the 2013-2014 service year, school-based health centers served over 23,000 students, and that was over almost 70,000 visits. So at school-based health centers, we do have a lot of clients that come back to the school-based health center for more services. And with those 68 certified school-based health centers in Oregon, in the 2013-2014 school year, over 52,000 school-aged children ages 5 to 21 had access to those services.
Question?
Yes, sir.
How many school districts are you missing?
Oh, a whole lot. How many school districts are in Oregon?
197.
Yeah.
Is it primarily an urban program then?
No, actually, we have more schools in rural. And you should have received a handout with a map of the school-based health centers.
Okay.
I did bring some today. So there's a map that shows where it is. And actually, the school-based health center program, Multnomah County has a number of school-based health centers. But if you look at the map, we really are throughout the state in 20 counties. And we do serve a lot of very rural areas. All right. So funding sources for school-based health centers in Oregon. Through our office, we get general fund money, money through House Bill 2445, which was passed in 2013, and money from our State Addictions and Mental Health Division program, a sister agency in the Oregon Health Authority. With the funds we receive at the state, we support every school-based health center with some money to really help them stay open and stay operational. You'll see at the bottom of the slide, we provide counties that have one certified school-based health center $60,000 per year, and then counties with more than one $53,000 per year per center. That obviously is not going to be enough to run a robust primary care clinic for the populations that the school-based health centers serve. So local school-based health centers get money in many different ways. Medical sponsors, revenue from billing and fees was brought up, some fundraising, sometimes hospitals give money to the school-based health center. And again, that depends on the community where the school-based health center is and how the model works for them. On the billing piece, in the 2013-2014 school year, school-based health centers received more than $2.25 million in claims from public and private insurers. So we do bill for services at school-based health centers and have the ability to do
that.
We
have a question.
Does the school board direct those decisions, or are school-based health centers run by another entity?
That's a great question. School boards are usually very involved in the planning process of a school-based health center, and they usually give the yes, we want to have a school-based health center in our district. How involved the school board is as time goes on is going to depend, again, on the community. Each school-based health center is going to be a little bit unique to the community. In general, the day-to-day running of a school-based health center, the clinic operations are going to be run by the primary care provider who is in charge of that center, who is under a medical sponsorship.
So the district doesn't do the billing or any of the rest of it?
It's usually done through the medical sponsor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
As a comment to follow up on that, whatever this task force comes up with, I think Representative Cruz and I hopefully would agree that we need to keep that. The support local has been defining, because there's been some issues where people are afraid of school-based health clinics because it comes out of some other place instead of the local community, what they're doing and everything. I hope you know what I'm talking about.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I really appreciate that comment. Okay. And that's why we take such care with our planning site process. We really want to be good stewards of this model, and we really want to make sure that if a school-based health center is going to go into a community in a school setting and be certified, that it's going to have support of the community. We think that's really important, and that's really an integral part of our planning process, that the community is engaged and involved before the school-based health center goes live, if you will, and starts offering services. So I really appreciate that.
Cindy.
I was looking at your map. Thank you. I noticed that there's some counties that are fairly populated, like Marion and Lynn, that there's no school-based health centers mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. So how are the services being provided to the kids in those counties? Is there an alternative method or
instructional assistance?
Well,
the school-based health center, it really serves as a primary care clinic. Mm-hmm. So students can access those services in their community. Again, we go through this planning process, and it might have been going through the planning process with the community. They decided it just wasn't important. And maybe in some of those more populated areas, there are more options for accessing primary care than there are in some less populated areas or some areas that may be struggling with different issues.
Question?
Yes.
You keep emphasizing the community has to support the school-based. What's your definition of community? Do you require advisory boards? Do you require medical people? Are you allowing a school board to participate?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you have a definition in your process of what a community is?
We don't. and again, I think that's because each community in Oregon is unique. I will say that in our planning process, we do involve the medical care providers in the community. We are not setting up school-based health centers to be in competition with other primary care providers. We involve the school boards. We involve the school where the center will be. We involve parents. We really work to make sure that there's a broad capture of what community is.
So a county health department combined with a school board could submit an application to become a school-based program?
Absolutely, yes. Our planning grants are competitive. Yep. They need to apply. The application comes from the county health department. Our funds flow through the local public health authorities. And so the county health department, the way it is now, needs to be the applicant. But they absolutely need to work with the community. We have not had a situation, nor would we support a situation, where the county health department decides there's going to be a school-based health center in a school, and then it's opened up. We've talked a lot this morning about school nursing and school-based health centers, so this just gives you a snapshot of some of the differences between the two, but we really do see them as a collaborative relationship, and we appreciate the opportunities in the future to be able to speak about how we can better integrate school nursing under the purview of Oregon Department of Education and school-based health centers under the purview of the Oregon Public Health Division and the Oregon Health Authority. School-based health centers certainly are not meant to replace school nursing. School nurses have unique and very valuable skills that they bring in helping students access learning. School-based health centers are there to provide primary care, and mental health care, dental care. When I say primary care, I mean that pretty comprehensively in school-based health centers. But an example of that collaborative relationship could be exactly what the presenter before me spoke about with the earache situation. If there's a school-based health center on site, then you can send them to a clinician who can prescribe medication, who can really get that earache situation solved. The same with immunizations. If there's a need for immunizations, there's a school nurse that realizes they're behind on immunizations, you can send the child to a school-based health center. Not every school nurse is going to have that accessibility. We only have 68 school-based health centers, but where that is, we certainly do want to make sure that there are collaborative relationships between the two different systems.
If you already mentioned this, I'm sorry that I just didn't absorb it. Do you know, or can you tell us, what percentage of kids have access on site? They're at a school that has a school-based health center? What percentage of Oregon school kids?
So if we know what number that school kids are in Oregon, we could figure that out. So 52,000, just over 52,000 youth have access to a school-based health center, meaning they have a school-based 10%. Health center at their school.
52 out of 650,000?
Yeah. So
it's only 10%.
Yeah,
10%.
So one way of looking at it is if we have good billing procedures in place, we might be recovering about 10% of what we could bill for.
Makes sense to me.
Is that about is that what we could conclude?
And I would add, Mr. Chair, I would also add that our students would be provided a more comprehensive health care than they currently are through their school secretaries and instructional assistants. Mm-hmm. So they might be more healthy and able to stay in school a little longer.
With trained personnel.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to speak a little bit about how school-based health centers are connected to health system transformation. So earlier I mentioned House Bill 2445, which really has allowed us to expand the school-based health center model. If you have the map in front of you, you'll see that we have 10 planning sites in 9 counties. We're hopeful that those planning sites will become certified school-based health centers at the end of the school year. So if I report to you next year, my number would go from 68 to 78. It really does, again, depend on the community wanting that model there for that to come true. But we're here to help make that happen. House Bill 2445 also looked at incentivizing school-based health centers to do innovation work to support these three goals: increasing the number of school-based health centers certified as patient-centered primary care homes, looking at the coordination of care of services of students who are served in a CCO setting and at a school-based health center, and then improve the effectiveness of the delivery of health services through school-based health centers for students who qualify for medical assistance. So one of the ways we're doing this is we have a technical assistance grant to the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance, and they are interviewing all of our school-based health center staff and then CCO staff in those communities where there are school-based health centers, saying, how can we make this work? How can we make this work in your community? And something that's coming of those conversations is we've been asked to host regional meetings with CCOs and school-based health centers together to talk about what better integration might look like. And it will probably look different in different communities. And so that's why we've really been asked to do it regionally instead of at the statewide level. So that's some work that we're moving forward on. The innovation grants, which are listed, the grantees are listed here, are really specific to those three sort of areas, and the different recipients are looking at primary care, patient-centered home recognition, really working on having that happen, the care coordination efforts, and then also looking at alternative payment methodologies. So if we are providing these services, we really can draw down the funding that's appropriate for the provision of those services. You'll see that there are recipients, some are CCOs, some are the local public health authority, some are community health centers. They all have to work with school-based health center system and CCOs to have received this grant. And the idea of this innovation grant is we can take lessons learned from each of these grantees and then move it out to our system. So, you know, what were your challenges around getting patient-centered primary care certified? How could we mitigate those challenges going forward? What alternative payment methodologies can you come up with so we are more robustly billing for and being reimbursed for the services that we provide? We're hoping to take that out system-wide. These innovation grants are a one-time only grant, and they do end on June 30th, 2015.
Quick question.
I have one too.
Another set of regional institutions in the state are called education service districts. How many of those have become applicants for your grant?
Well, they wouldn't have become eligible for this grant because it either had to come from a CCO or an SBHC medical sponsor in collaboration with one another.
But they could if they were partners.
They could be
partners. Or had signed an intergovernmental agreement or a memorandum of understanding. Is that
absolutely
correct?
Absolutely.
Perhaps this is a dumb question, but if school-based health centers are a primary care provider, are they operating year-round? What happens to their operations during summer months, for example?
Great question. Some of it goes back to what the community can offer and support. if they're a patient-centered primary care home, they have to be accessible 24/7, at least by phone, if no other way. And they have to have a model for providing care, obviously, throughout the year. Now, they might have an agreement in their community with another care provider, or they might be open year-round. A handful of our school-based health centers are open year-round and do offer services year-round.
In your planning process, is the existence of school nurses incorporated into planning when you're working with a county health department and school districts to establish a school-based health clinic? Do you take into account whether or not they're school nurses and what they may provide to students?
Yes, that would be a consideration. And again, the planning process, we talked about being community-based, also is really sort of localized to the school, since school-based health centers are in a school. And so in the best case scenario, if a school nurse were at that school nurse would be very involved with the process as well. That is a recommendation that we would make. Whether that happens or not, again, we really try and give the community control of that process.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'm trying to recall the words that were on a previous slide. I was particularly interested in technical assistance grants to help existing school-based health centers become more effective and efficient, in particular related to business practices and billing. And I'm looking at the bill that was adopted and enrolled, and it lists specifically assist school-based health centers in improving business practices, including practices related to billing and efficiencies. I don't see that on a previous slide. Are you providing technical assistance to existing SBHCs to do this?
We are, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, and we're doing that specifically on the business practices piece. That is part of our contract with the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance.
Thank you.
So a little bit more on SBHCs and health system transformation. So we also have Senate Bill 436 that requires, to the extent practicable, that community health improvement plans adopted by coordinated care organizations and community advisory councils include a focus on integrating health and education, which I think would be very important to note for this committee. School-based health centers are mentioned in that bill in various ways, looking at evaluating the adequacy of the existing network to meet the pediatric and adolescent health care needs, making recommendations to improve the system, including electronic health record and billing systems improvement, and consider whether integration of school-based health centers with the larger systems would advance the goals of the community health improvement plan. An important note on this is that SB 436 did not have funding attached to it. But we just wanted to highlight it as we do, you know, have this in mind. From the State Program Office, we are looking at community health improvement plans and seeing how school-based health centers fit in with theirs. So to the extent practicable, as the bill says, and possible for us, we are keeping these things in mind as we move forward and trying to assure that SBHCs are a robust part of our health transformation here in the state.
What's EHR?
Pardon me?
EHR.
EHR is electronic health record. Thank you for asking. We're also involved in some national policy efforts. You know, healthcare transformation, though we like to be, you know, say we're on the cutting edge in many ways in Oregon, it's also happening in other states. And there are school-based health centers in many states. So the National School-Based Health Alliance is sponsoring 18-month learning collaboratives, and Oregon is proud to be able to participate in that. And the goal of that is really to look at policies that support the value of the full integration of school health care within emerging organizational and financial models to achieve the high-quality, cost-effective, population-focused health care that we're all really concerned about. Oregon's team, which just met in September and will be going to a national learning collaborative meeting in November, includes someone from the school-based health center state program office, the Primary Care Association, the School-Based Health Alliance, State Medicaid Office, CARE Oregon, and there's also an independent consultant on the team. So we'll be sharing what we're doing in Oregon and learning from partners in other states and how we can really advance policies to move health school-based health centers forward as part of a national model of health care. Again, really want to thank you for considering health so carefully. As an education work group, I'm sure you have a whole lot of education things that you've needed to talk about as well, but really appreciate that you all recognize the interconnection, and I'm happy to answer questions as I'm able.
Other questions on school-based health centers? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, does the ORS, does it allow school-based health clinics to use retired medical professionals, nurses, doctors?
As long as you're licensed.
We've had an organization in Central Oregon called Volunteers in Medicine, mm-hmm. and we passed a law that allowed them to not be licensed or to provide services. So would you be receptive? Do you think that would be a benefit to the program? Any ideas on that?
It's something I would need to look into.
What's happened, they've called me up, and with the new extended Oregon health plan, they've got less work, less demand on volunteer an organization like that.
Sure.
And there's others in the state, too. Thank you. I'd be interested if you report or to Richard, tell Richard, let Richard
Mr.
know
Chair,
what you find out.
Is it possible to get a copy of the set of slides? And I also would like to point out we have unlicensed, uncertified secretaries, educational assistants doing medical care in schools.
Absolutely.
And I would think you'd be very open having formerly licensed, retired, but still vigorous elders assisting in communities.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Montgomery. It's something I would actually need to refer to the ORS and the OAR to see what's outlined there very specifically around that question.
Darren.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the slides are also available on OLIS right now, so you can, they're
great.
Available. They're open and available to the public right now.
Excellent.
A couple slides back, you showed the different partners that were connected to the health centers with regard to finance, mm-hmm. and it mentioned school districts. On average, how much does a school district put in financially to have one of those health-based centers in their school district? So what kind of resources is the school district putting into that process? I'm sure it varies from place to place, but is there most of the money, some of the money? How does that work?
I would probably say very little of the money, and I could check on that and get back to you. We do ask school-based health centers to report to us their financing and funding streams and where they get that. It does vary quite a bit, and I would say that it's definitely not most of their funding, but I can check.
Is it usually like around space and
yes, and yeah, it's usually like in-kind space donation. That's very typical relationship with
a school. Normal to see, as we were talking a little bit about having a secretary or somebody in there, the district's paying for it to make
no.
things
yeah.
go and happen.
It's not, that wouldn't be.
Okay.
Yes.
To that, a secretary cannot go into a school-based health center and provide health care services the way they can in a classroom. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to keep them in the classroom to do that. I was... Never mind.
Okay.
Thank you.
Question. You may not know the answer to this, but is it possible... building on something Representative Nathanson said a little while ago. Is it possible, though, that if the law provided it, that school-based health centers could actually be an umbrella over all the schools? So then a school nurse located within a school that didn't happen to have a school-based center in that school, but it was under the umbrella of a school-based health center in the county, could then provide billable services?
I think that would require a change in the law. As it stands right now, I don't believe that's possible.
But nothing federal would stop that from happening. Is that correct?
I cannot honestly answer that question, not that I'm aware of, though.
If Margo, do you know the answer to that question?
I don't know nationally.
Oh, I'm sorry. You need to come up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Comments as well. I'm allowed to make them, but
But in Oregon, I don't think we're excluded from exploring that as an option. There are clearly nursing services that are billable and reimbursable, not just in a school-based health setting, but in a public health department setting as well. In many health departments, it is nurses that deliver the billable care, whether it's a maternal child health program.
Right, but as it stands today, an RN mm-hmm. in a school-based health center providing some sort of service mm-hmm. that would be billable, the school nurse providing that exact same service in a school, not under the umbrella of a school-based health center, would not be billable.
Correct. And in the slide related to the difference between school nursing and school-based health centers, a couple things worthy of correction is that the school nurse does deliver medications a lot in a school setting
right.
and does manage both acute and chronic health needs at both extremes. So, and many of those services in any other setting except for the school classroom setting would be reimbursable and billable. So
I think I would say that there may be some other opportunities to explore rather than sort of creating a school-based health center umbrella. Could it be just as simple as saying school nurses can bill for those services regardless of whether there's a school-based health center or not?
Right. Then we wouldn't have to, Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Go ahead.
I was wondering about that point, because if we have to put them under a school-based health center, that's a whole bunch of different regulations and different requirements that wouldn't be necessary if we're talking about a school nurse. If we're trying to get to billing,
that's what
I think we should just go straight to billing.
Yeah.
Not necessarily create something that has a bunch of hoops we have to jump through.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just offer that while, you know, money certainly is a very important part of this conversation, that it's the delivery of school services and the design and system for doing that that is as much an important part of this conversation. And in listening to the presentation is that, you know, really out in the field, there's lots of collaboration. But you've heard a lot about health transformation. You've heard a lot about grants. You've heard about a lot of this work going on. For a program that serves about 10% of the existing population right now in school nursing, which is assigned to the whole population, because Department of Ed, school nursing has not been a part of any of those conversations, is not part of health transformation conversations, not part of any of these work groups, is not at all. And so that's very concerning to me, and I think the state needs to be really concerned about that if it's looking at health transformation and the whole population. And even on the website, the standards, which I commend that they exist for school-based health centers, and the reporting mechanism for that, that does not exist at all in the state of Oregon for the delivery of school health services, and a lot of money is being put into it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to try to get going here. Mr. Ross, do you have anything you wanted to add?
The only thing I'd add, Chairman, it's clear that you want to get at the possibility of increasing the billing for all the access points in schools. And from the Medicaid program's perspective, if the right statutory framework were in place, I think there's some improvement that could be made there. There would still be work to do around licensure, credentialing, federal regulation in the Medicaid program about what kind of a billing provider can be reimbursed and what the supervision of those providers would have to be. Okay. And that's why primary care homes can bill now and a nurse-only clinic, wouldn't be able to without the right supervision. And then the other regulatory aspects that we would research and take into consideration is the FERPA regulations under the Department of Education, and that the purpose is providing and ensuring access for the child to their free and public education versus the HIPAA regulations that regulate the healthcare system. And right now we have some interactions that we've witnessed between those two systems. They weren't really built at the federal level to work together, even though that coordination happens on the ground in schools. It's a bit of a barrier to that.
But in school nursing, actually, because you had FERPA up there, and we work under both HIPAA and FERPA, and actually one of the good things is that the school nurse actually has access, works under both, and has access to both. So the school nurse has access to the student information system and can use that in order to support and implement, whether it's, you know, a population-based program or a direct service for the student. But they have to manage the health care under HIPAA. And so the information the school can access from the nurse is limited. But school nurses have access to both, but school nurses cannot share all that information with school-based health centers as well. So we actually have access to way more information.
So we have one other person to hear from a county health perspective. Mm-hmm. Ms. Delavern Brown, you are there, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Hello, thank you so much. This is Muriel Delavern Brown. I'm public health director in Crook County in Prineville. I'm also the chair of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. And what's interesting about this topic, I actually started my career as a school nurse at Thurston High School for 12 years, and then have been in public health, including Douglas County, where I came from. And I supervise the school base in Douglas County. And then currently in Crook County, we actually got the planning grant, and we went through the whole process here and have a school-based health center here in Crook County. So a little bit about how we do it. As I was listening to everyone, and the way we've done it here has been incredibly collaborative, probably because I was a school nurse and I understood the importance of that. But the school nurse here in Crook County was instrumental in working with me on the planning grant. We met with the school district, we met with numerous partners to find a medical sponsor, because I think I am not an FQHC. I'm in a building with an FQHC, Mosaic Medical, and I really reached out to them to be the medical sponsor for our school base. So it was a community decision. I think the health department's role was critical in that we brought all those partners together and many community partners to kind of look at the location, and we did the kind of that background planning of looking at a community assessment, look at really what was the need in Crook County. So we started the clinic, that was a few years back. We started it part-time, and then we sort of reevaluated a year and a half ago. The way our structure works is different than it is in some counties. I actually take my $60,000, I pay for a 0.25 of the school nurse, because Wendy is critical to kind of how the school base works, making sure kids get into the school base and all of that work. And then I also do a monthly amount at the time to Mosaic Medical, because we weren't sure if we could get this up and going, and they really needed some support to do that. So about a year and a half ago, we looked at what the need was in Crook County, and we actually, this was the really exciting part. Everybody said that what we really needed was a pediatrician. We did not have a pediatrician in Crook County. So Mosaic recruited. We actually now have a clinic that the pediatrician is in there 4 days a week, and the other day we have another staff from Mosaic, and Wendy actually works in that office part of that day as her kind of the 0.25 piece. And then, I think that collaborative between all of us, we are also open all summer, so we run it full time. I think some of the thoughts that have come up about school-based, I think one of the things is that really this community, because Mosaic Medical has their FQHC, we have St. Charles here in town, really only one school-based health center can really be supported in this community. We had those discussions about putting one in another center, but between the size of the community, it's sort of next to a school, but off-site a little bit. It's in a separate building, so community members bring the kids, and it's also walking distance from the high school and the junior high. So not only is it walking, but then the parents sort of bring their kids to it. So when we had this discussion, we didn't think we could support a second clinic, I think the other piece about it and some of the billing on the school nurse side, I know there's administrative match and administrative claiming on that side. One of the challenges that comes up, but we even run into this on the public health side, the Medicaid rules are really stringent around, as an example, if somebody would come into the health department for an STD exam, basically we get no money for it because it's not the initial, it's the initial appointment with them has to be with another provider. You can't, the way it's all set up, there's no code very much. So I think school nurses run into the same thing. It has to do with some of the Medicaid rules. The other piece too, being a nurse, some of it has to do with standing orders. So what we do with Wendy is when Wendy is helping out with immunizations in the school or we're going to do a clinic or something happens, Wendy actually works under, we have an agreement, so she works under the standing orders of my health officer at the health department. So we might be a little unusual here in the way we've structured it, but it really is important to look at what the community needs are. And I know from my standpoint, it was really important for me to have this clinic here. Most of the work from the health department side, I hate to say this, but most work from the health department side is really in kind because it was important to us that we had a clinic in this community. So I think we're lucky that the community is a little bit smaller. One of the things we've worked on in Central Oregon really hard is we've talked about school-based a lot with our CCO. We also are working that every one of, our goal is that every school-based in Central Oregon have a medical sponsor. And that really has improved the billing because once they're a medical sponsor, it really is primary care centered home. They can bill when you have that medical sponsor set up like we do with Mosaic Medical or if the health department happens to be an FQHC. But that was really the model that could support itself a lot more. So that's how we do it in Kirk County. And it's exciting after all these years to hear the conversation about the school nurses because my heart has always been there. So I think here we do have a lot of collaboration between school-based and the school district and the school nurses, but I think that could improve overall across the state.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Nathanson.
I have a general comment about school-based health centers, and I know I'm possibly a little bit out of sync with quite a few people on this, but I understand the aspiration of school-based health centers being primary patient-centered primary care homes. I understand the importance that they can serve in a community that doesn't otherwise have a clinic of any sort. But there are areas in our state, my community is one, where there's more than one place for a family to get health care for children or for the whole family. And I've been concerned that our rules and aspirations about asking so much of school-based health centers to be so much for the community and to be such a full-service type facility with requirements for hours open and language assistance being offered, just all sorts of things, that we are actually holding back communities or school districts from establishing more school-based health centers just because the amount of requirement we put on them is tremendous. I don't think school-based health centers need to be all things for all people in every community. If in a community where you've already got an FQHC or some other sort of community clinic, why couldn't we have some other level of school-based health center with a much reduced obligation that sort of implies you've got to be everything to every child and every family? I think we may be causing some of this absence of school-based health clinics.
So this is Muriel. I'd just like to respond to that from our perspective. When I was a school nurse, there were like so many, and I know things were really different because that was a while ago, but there were so many times that I wish there was a place I could get that kid into because their parents wouldn't necessarily take them or there wasn't that option. I think for school-based, it's really about access. And if you call many of the clinics in town, there's a wait to get in. There's not at school-based. They pretty much much can walk in. So it really improves access for kids. I think the other thing, too, is it gives those teenagers and other ones who just need to talk to somebody. So one of the other things I didn't mention about our school base is that we have Advantage Dental who comes in and will do some work there, some screening and types of things. The other thing is, fortunately, in one of the clinics, I got one of the mental health grants, so we actually have a full-time therapist there. So if someone comes in to see the physician, they can actually just go right into the next part of the building and see a mental health therapist. So I think that for kids, it's extremely important that they have the ability to be able to kind of have their needs met. And I even from a small clinic, I don't think the requirements were so challenging that it made it a barrier for us. I mean, it's not easy, but I didn't feel like it was a barrier to us opening a clinic here in Prineville.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Cruz, Representative Nathanson, both of you have been working on this issue. Where do you think we go from here?
I think we can continue conversations, and those who have presented today, we're certainly anxious to get help from you all, and I talked to Cindy about conversations at the department as well. And we have expanded the conversations. I had a conversation last week with ONA, letting them know where we're going. Bottom line, at the end of the day, one of the things we've attempted to do in healthcare is make sure that everybody can operate at the top of their license. And that's one of the things that needs to be addressed here. It clearly does. The other thing is reimbursement and what umbrella this falls under. I personally think that we're looking for medical home. That's what a CCO is supposed to be, you know, with the various pods in it. Now, one thing that did cause me a little bit of concern was the conversation about public health, because I think public health in and of itself may be taking a slightly different turn, because there's been a work group working on that. And so I'm not sure that's necessarily the home. I think the CCOs are. I know that Mona Anderson and Greenlick have been working on some concepts with public health and kind of hoping to redefine that mission, which is outside of the purview of this potentially. But I think we are committed to continuing our efforts. Like I said, we have draft language in, and it is purely draft language. The only thing I wanted to make sure we had was the right relating clauses, and we do. So, you know, the rest of it's skeleton. So if you see LC drafts, don't worry about it. We're looking to put some meat on those bones, and I think, Nancy, we're looking for help from anybody who's got a good idea at this point.
Right. Thank you. I agree. We have not landed on one specific detailed solution. It's possible that in one region of the state versus another, it may be easier to implement a certain type of solution than another type. But I think, in the simplest terms, please correct me if this is the wrong way to say it, one of our two objectives is to create a structure to enable billing so that we can get these costs off the back of the education system,
yeah,
put it onto the health system.
Yes.
It's to create a structure to enable the billing to work.
That's where we started. But you know, I've been involved in healthcare for only 18 years in this building, so not that long. but one of the things, Triple Aim was mentioned here earlier. Representative Greenlick, 3 years ago, when we had the big meetings every Wednesday night over at Willamette University on it, made a point on the very front end of that. We're talking healthcare reform, and basically his question is, before we go there, shouldn't we figure out and solve the structural problems in the medical care arena? And that's to a degree what we're talking about, is the medical care arena, and and making that connected. So I kind of, you know, there's a lot of potentially good stuff, but until we have the medical structure in place, everything else, you know, it's tough to put the appropriate bells and whistles on. So I know you may be surprised, but actually Mitch and I agree on a lot of stuff. So.
Tricia.
Mr. Chair,
Muriel, can I add one thing before I
go ahead, Muriel?
So the one thing I would say about the public health piece is that school-based health centers are not just a clinic, and that's, I think, the piece that's really, that's sort of that public health piece. So there's pieces in there where we're doing health promotion, there's pieces where we're working with families, and we're really working with the school district on sort of on that health, on that other side of it, sort of that public health promotion side. So I think somebody asked me that question one day. It's sort of like, well, what if, you know, public health or somebody wasn't involved in what school-based is? And I think because school-based is so community, that's really the role that public health plays in that. Because, and I know for myself, when there's anything that deals with, you know, whether it's communicable disease or whatever, the superintendent's on the phone with me. So I think the public health role is really important as a partner. And I know in this community, they have felt extremely, you know, they feel like that's an important partner at the table because we provide that education side. So anyway, just my two cents.
Thank you. Tricia?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate what Senator Cruz has said and also what we heard from the school-based health center folks, but the disconnect seems to me to be between our traditional way of dealing with sick kids, which is school nurses and school secretaries, and our new way of dealing with sick kids, which is school-based health centers. And in this map, my county doesn't have a single one of them, even though it has tens of thousands of students. We, I think, as a committee, could include and should include in our report the possibility of, while we wait for school-based health clinics to catch up and become present everywhere, we still need to deal with our school nurse problem in those places where we don't have health centers. And a big piece of the barrier between providing school nurses in schools is funding. And so I think that we should take a close look at what's happened in Multnomah County with regard to the provision of health care services, which is a hybrid. It's not just health centers. There are lots of school nurses. And how they have maximized their funding sources and where the barriers really are to our providing more school nurses to provide health care services in schools. That it seems to me to be just a total no-brainer and something that we could work on through this committee and our report.
I agree. I think this topic will have a prominent place in our report. I think it has to. Obviously, we're going to continue to hear from Senator Cruz and Representative Nathanson and others as they go forward with this bill language. And obviously, we're going to continue to take advantage of the outstanding expertise that we heard here today mm-hmm. in filling in the kind of skeleton that Senator Cruz referred to as the session moves forward. Ms. Wimmer.
And I would have one request as we develop this report and also rely on some of the expertise in the room of what statutory language ought to be in place in order for the money to flow. And other things as well. Key to me is what Margo said about access, and so I would hope that whatever we do with respect to proposed legislation, we also make it very clear that any money that would be freed up on the education side, because we were able to expand billing or other kinds of resources more cleverly, that money would go to buying down the school nurse ratios to students and to increasing student access statewide to health services in school settings.
Small problem there. But we'll talk about it later. I, you know, I My whole purpose, one of my, I have many purposes, but one of them is to try to get as much of the formula dollars in the system into the classroom as possible, and which is why, we're talking about medical homes, and we're talking about the fact that we don't have the state covered with school-based health centers. We do have the state covered with CCOs. It's amazing how that happened. I'm not sure. But anyway, and that was kind of a joke. Because I do know how it happened, but that's a medical home. And so it's how we blend all these things together under that umbrella. By the way, we are probably not going to totally solve this problem in 15, but I think we can make some strides because we're not only talking about the structure here, but we're talking about the Medicaid structure, and that those portions are still in DHS, and how we transition it into what we're supposed to be a global budget, but we are light years away from there at this point in time. So, you know, there are a lot of issues here, but I think Representative Nathans and I, when we started this thing, was looking at the appropriate billing and getting the dollars back in the classroom.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up to that. Agreed, but it would be a shame, it would seem to me, if all we did is shift the funding source and still remained one of the worst states in the nation, or the worst state in the nation in terms of access for kids.
No, totally agreed, but it's structure other places. So
we ready for a transition here, and just for the record, I want to remind everyone that we didn't start until about 10:15, so we're still going to make our 2 hours. No, Representative. No, that wasn't intended at you.
Punishing the rest of the class for me, Mr.
He's a North Carolina fan. You can't really expect much from him. It's just
after our last discussion on collaborative operational agreements, you asked if I would go ahead and write something up. So I took my notes and I attempted to do that. And so what you have in front of you is the new version of kind of what is the draft now. And with the idea here is that we said in last session, let's start off by looking at technical assistance grants and not looking at the implementation, that financial incentive kind of thing, but instead providing strong expertise and help in a region that wants to look at putting something like this together to maximize efficiencies and hopefully even improve service. So you have that in front of you. The language down below Cindy provided, it's referring to what was written in bullet number 3 parenthetically there. So at this point, open to discussion on anything here, Senator Cruz.
First bullet, I would revise it to say provide assistance to school districts, education, service districts, and or community colleges. I would eliminate groups of 3 or more. Provide assistance to groups makes it plural, so it isn't just one cowboy going out on his own, but there are parts in the state where I think we may find that a collaboration between 2 entities may be a valuable thing.
So you'd leave the word groups in there?
Yeah, I'd leave the word groups in just to make sure that we aren't having one person go out and do something. But just, I mean, you're trying to keep it as loose as possible as far as definitional as to who's in and who's out and how big it could be. And I'm saying what may work for 3, there are some areas where it may work for 2 as well. So
I know that I'm okay with that. Others, anyone have a problem with that? So it would read, provide assistance to groups of school districts, et cetera.
Yeah, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Others.
Okay,
I'm sorry?
I'm asking the boss.
Oh, me. So the language that I put under section one, because I was trying to, I saw a couple of holes, and so a couple of the holes, and thank you, Jim, for getting us started.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it does say three or more down in your section.
Yeah, it does. Well, I was trying to capture what Jim said up here right. as much as possible. And then what I did, like, you know, I had basically the department awarding these grants. I added in that they weren't just for technical assistance, but also for planning purposes, because I think that's what I heard a lot of people say last time, and it kind of made sense to me, too. Also, the technical assistance being provided not just by qualified public education entities, but also other entities that, like, either we would identify or the groups. I was trying to give as much flexibility as possible. I can tell you in some of our strategic investments this time around, we have contracts with some experts to provide services to different, you know, grant recipients who, I don't know, were smaller or didn't have expertise in those areas, that kind of thing. So I wanted to be, like I said, as flexible as possible. Like in this example, maybe, gosh, so like a non-public education entity, something like for, I know. So we have some retirees in the state, and I know of one sitting here, but I'm not touting his service necessarily. But anyway, so we have some retirees who are ex-superintendents, who are ex-business managers, that kind of thing, and they've formed their own, you know, business. But they're not a public educational entity. They contract for services with public educational entities to do analyses, that kind of thing. For example, with Oregon School for the Deaf, a couple of years ago, we were asked by the legislature to analyze the staffing model for the Oregon School for the Deaf. We went out and did a contract with some retirees, former superintendents, that kind of thing, you know, to do that kind of work. So that's why I was expanding this out to not just be other public education entities doing the technical assistance piece. It could be someone that was contracted with or found or something.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Does that suppose that the Department of Education is going to have some staff people who will examine and certify other entities as being qualified to provide this kind of assistance? Because we're talking about assistance to superintendents by superintendents. So how do we know which superintendents know and which ones don't know?
But you would have had the same issue with the School for the Deaf, correct?
Yeah.
So what's the answer then?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it could be done in a couple of different ways. One way would be, you know, the regions would come forward with their plans and say, you know, we have found this group that
we like Charlie,
great.
And we'd like you to hire Charlie.
Possibly, like not hire us Charlie? Hire, but the region. This is someone we trust, you know, that kind of a thing. Another option is that we have a contractor that we've contracted with, and we say to the regions, okay, this person's service is available to you to use. So
does the department evaluate that service to determine whether or not it's appropriate before
yeah.
you recommend them?
Yeah,
do you
in the
evaluate
instances,
them
yeah.
and
the,
certify
right.
them?
Yeah, the examples I can think of with the strategic initiatives, the contractors that we have are viewed as state or in some cases national experts. So yeah.
By somebody in the department?
Not just by us in the department, but nationally.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
When this regional task force was created, it was to look at the provision of services by public entities in education more efficiently, whether it be ESDs or collaboratives formed by ESDs. And I'd really rather stick to our mission on this and not keep opening it up to privatizing it to other businesses or retirees or whatever. I think the more tightly focused we remain on our original core mission for this task force, which is to figure out ways for ESDs and other regional entities that are products of that public service to figure out ways to help each other collegially, that's what I am able to support on behalf of my organization. I can't go for the Department of Education awarding collaborative grants to whomever and just kind of handing it off. That's not what we had in mind.
Yeah, and I agree with you. The only concern I want to make sure that the group knows about is that when districts in the past have gone out and tried to find consultants, let's say, to come in and do something as sensitive as this could be, most of the folks who are operating in their own district or ESD or community college now kind of shy away from that, even though they might have the tremendous amount of expertise to say, no, I don't want to go in and tell that organization how to run their business.
Well, what if it were, and I'm thinking in terms of where the money would come from for these grants anyway, rather than doing technical grants being awarded by the department, what if it were just made a part of the resolution services that ESDs could have on their list of possible uses of dollars, and then they could do that on a contract basis within the ESD?
That would work.
Let's do it that way.
I have no problem with that. That would work.
Yeah, I thought we were overcomplicating this. And actually, because I think for a lot of it, if, you know, assuming that these school districts, even the little ones, have smart people working there, we can assume that. Okay. And we're creating a pathway for them to do some collaborative things and combine a lot of administrative functions. This, we aren't inventing something here. Okay. I mean, to a large degree, it's all doable. So I think that's probably a good way to go about this.
There's got to be some flexibility. I appreciate what my colleagues are saying. At the same time, Jim, we've come across that before, where if we're really going to use the internal partners, it's hard sometimes to find people that could really know that. Mentor grant, I'm thinking of, we use a national organization that helps set those standards. Well, that provides us with a really good ability to sit and listen and have that conversation with that group, and provides our groups of districts in this area, as I was talking about before, a set of standards we can use or adjust to accordingly. So that makes some sense. I appreciate what you're trying to say. I like the idea of being a little bit flexible in the process. I want to get to the point of getting it done.
Right.
Yeah, and there's certainly flexibility in the way Lori worded it. And Cindy, I assume you could write that up.
Yeah, so the resolution services, the one, here's the pushback I would give on that, is that we've had examples of ESDs in front of us who have done these analyses very effectively, and they've been great examples, right? But that's not the ones we're probably talking about, to be honest. We're probably talking about other ESDs that we haven't heard from and who have been less successful in this area. So all ESDs right now can do this through resolution services, and yet some aren't.
No.
So if we just allow it, I'm not sure that I have faith that those other ESDs we haven't heard from will do it.
And it wouldn't have to be ESDs. Lori, correct me if I'm mistaken here. I think what you're after is, we're talking about the public entities here who are joining together and saying, we want to look at this. If the public entities together are hiring whoever, that meets your criteria because the public entities are doing the hiring, correct?
That's right, not the department.
Okay.
And furthermore, if we're not making this compulsory in any case. So when we've got some ESDs who have this service to offer, I'm assuming they will market it to their colleagues.
Right, right.
And if those colleagues elect to take advantage of that service, they shall.
I know that the folks that I represent probably would want me to say, boy, it should be the... But I'm feeling a little uncomfortable here. So I think it'd be fantastic if it was just the public entities that are entering into this project would hire whoever they chose. That way the department wouldn't have to be certifying anybody.
And that way, if there's an ESD that's doing it well and these folks over here aren't getting what they want here, they can go over here and get it.
That's right.
Very simple.
Wherever they want to go.
Very simple, yes. Which would kind of put us burn the saddle of those who aren't doing it well, wouldn't it? Yes.
It would. And we've had examples of that in the past and
yes.
various other
yes.
kinds of things.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm somewhat uncomfortable defending
administrators. That's not my job. But but I do think that it would be a mistake of this committee to assume that where this hasn't happened, it should. There may be legitimate reasons for this not happening in some places. We've not heard so much about why it hasn't happened where it hasn't happened. What we've heard about are successes where it has happened. That doesn't...
Okay, we're going to reconvene the Committee on Regional Service Delivery. Ms. Wimmer.
Yes. When we first looked at this language, it didn't occur to me, but it has since come to my attention that there are two items that are listed in that first bullet point that probably we should save for another day or remove, and that would be food service and transportation. And here are the reasons why I would say that. With respect to food service, the concept of potentially institutionalizing or regionalizing food service delivery probably goes against everything the state's been trying to do with farm to school and some of those other kinds of more by local kinds of programs, healthy, nutritious, site-based kind of things. And so to me, that would not be a good place for that adventurer to go. And the same is true with transportation, which relies on local route planning and a lot of other variables. That I think that those are just two really complex, murky areas that have political components in this building, and I would move that we strike that and or any other agreed upon non-instructional function and just end it at technology services.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would support Lori's proposal. I think we're biting off more than we can chew, and we really should focus. If we think this is a good idea, let's start small and build on success rather than trying to do everything all at once, whatever anybody wants. I think we've heard lots of good testimony about the need, for example, for regionalized help with the acquisition and training necessary for technology, both instructional technology and keep the district running technology, which are two separate tracks, and they seem like a fire hose that are burying districts today. If we could do that one thing, I would think that was a huge, huge success. And I think we shouldn't try to do everything all at once.
I know I'd certainly be in favor of having just the first four there. Anyone have a problem with that?
I think that's appropriate.
That's good. Yeah. Focus.
Yes.
Focus.
Yeah.
Good suggestion.
Business, fiscal services, human resources, legal services, and technology.
Those four, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Representative Wisnett, are you good with that?
Sure.
Okay. Everyone else is?
It's fine.
All right. That we'll make that change. Thank you for that. Let me make my note here. Okay. Others?
Yeah, Jim.
Yes.
We haven't talked about this. You had in your third bullet the right of first refusal language, and I took a look at the FDAB language specifically that you had referred to there.
Yes.
And it was sort of like an apples and oranges kind of a thing. The FDAB language is quite lengthy, and it specifically applies to teachers.
Okay.
And it specifically applies within, like, the same district. And so, and what I mean by, and public employees very specifically.
Yes.
And so the FDAB language, like, currently doesn't apply to, for example, classified, you know, non-teachers. So that was one thing. And then some of the services that we've heard about, they could involve non-public employees getting displaced. Now, I'll give you an example, like, and this is kind of a comical example because I'm a lawyer giving it, but anyway, is like legal services. So if another region decided to do the high desert model, for example, then districts within that region may not be hiring private lawyers, but we wouldn't want to give them, I'm guessing, a right of, I don't know.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I should say public employees, right?
So what I did instead is when you look down in section one on the service delivery analysis, there's the last line, and I said that the plan shall also identify any district employees that may be displaced. So district employees, I tried to say, you know, limit it to, like, those public employees. By the implementation of the plan and a proposed solution for the displacement. And the reason I left it at kind of a regional level is I know there's collective bargaining agreements in place that have very specific provisions around layoffs, what happens, that kind of thing. I didn't want to run amok of that. I know that we've heard things like, well, sometimes these things were implemented when someone was retiring, you know, so I don't know. I was thinking it would kind of vary from region to region and perhaps employer to employer and type of employee.
Mr. Chair, this was my suggestion, okay. And the piece under the FairDAB that I was referring to was that the qualification of skills for a transfer to a different job would be related to, the district may consider willingness to undergo additional training or pursue additional education in deciding upon questions of competence or capability in this case. That's mm-hmm. the language I was referring to. And that doesn't have to get bogged down by whether or not you're a licensed teacher in a RIF situation. It's just mimicking that language that we already have in the statute, that concept.
Yeah, that, but we also want to make sure we say public employees, right?
And public employees,
it must
right.
say public employees, not district employees.
Right.
And or maybe so the, public district employees.
The FairDAB RIF language was only with respect to that.
And the reason I had a problem with district
language.
Is because we have community colleges. Well, it's a community college district,
too.
I guess. Yeah. So we could say public district employees?
Mr. Chair, public employees.
Yes,
but
go
it
ahead,
was,
Tricia.
Yeah.
There is an existing statute, I believe, in 643. I was
right.
just looking for it.
Senate Bill 643.
Senate Bill 643, thank you. I knew there was a 643 in there somewhere.
Yep.
That says that when a program is transferred between public entities, that the staff in that program goes with the program. And
there's exceptions
to that. Yeah. And they are given they get to keep their benefits they've accrued and their salary range for a year.
For the first year, right.
I wouldn't want any language in this to mess with that.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
And Tricia, the FDAB language would apply to, and I don't think this is going to probably impact a lot of teachers, the kind of services that we're talking about, but if it did, the FDAB language is still there that would apply. The language, Tricia, you're talking about, because we haven't done anything in here to say that it doesn't apply,
right.
So it would.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then other, like I said, layoff procedures and things in the collective bargaining agreements would
right.
be the other
I just
piece.
Didn't want any language we put in here to be in conflict with existing statutes.
That's right.
That's
been complicated enough.
Yeah. Could I ask a question then, Cindy? What does the proposed solutions for the displacement mean to you? How would districts?
Yeah, to me what it meant was taking some of our examples that we've heard. I can't remember. Oh, boy. I think it was one of the ESDs, for example, that said that they combined the business services, but when they did that, there were individuals that had been like employed by a school district that they transferred to the ESD. So if the business analysis, looking at this, what I would anticipate is they would say, well, it looks like we could combine services and there's these employees over here who could be transferred to the ESD. That would be a proposed solution according to, you know, state law, collective bargaining agreement, et cetera. So that would be one proposed solution. Another one, though, could also be, we also heard this, is that we had this retirement, you know, and so then the proposed solution would be that position transferred. Maybe it's not the individual because they're retiring. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I don't really know what else we could do other than that because every situation is going to be so unique.
Or the third one I would say is the proposed solution is that we follow the local collective bargaining agreement
mm-hmm.
on how this kind of situation is handled. I mean, that would be, you know, a proposed.
Statutes and collective bargaining.
Yeah, well, and the reason I phrased it, frankly, as a proposed solution is that I didn't want this to trump the collective bargaining agreements.
Right.
And so it's proposed. This is one proposal. This person could move here, and also to trump the rights of the employer-employee relationships going on. And so that's, anyway, that's why I worded it as a proposed solution that those public entities could look at and go, okay, this is good for us or not, or what have you.
Well, and they'd be required to look under Senate Bill 643
exactly.
and under the collective bargaining agreements mm-hmm. already. So that makes sense to me that they would propose solutions, but they'd have to propose solutions that are underneath yeah. those.
Yeah. Well, it's got to mm-hmm. be as flexible as possible because these two districts are going to combine this function and Mary's a year from retirement, and so we're going to wait 1 year and then we'll do it. And so there's no reason to do anything with Mary on the front end because she's going to be gone anyway, sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So long as there was, as far as my concern is, of course, for our employees who might lose their jobs, as long as it was really clear either that the intent is that job retention for employees be the first, the first effort made, or somehow establishing legislative intent, whatever we have to do to clarify that the idea is to find efficiencies but not at the cost of jobs, which also affect the economic viability of communities.
As long as we keep in mind that one of the things that will happen here to get the efficiencies is there will be some loss of FTE. We know that.
Right.
You know, it's just the time frame and the structure of how you get there.
But I think I could go along with what you said to, make sure the intent of the committee is clear. Mm-hmm. That in this legislation it states that we if at all possible we want to retain, any displaced employees in some fashion that the plan should attempt to include that. Okay. That's the kind of language I used to agree to at the table. Mr. Montgomery.
What is the size of the grants that are been contemplated?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because that's when I said I had another point to make. I wanted to bring that up. And because you see under where Cindy had Section 1, that Section 2 says funding. So I would like to propose this, that in my experience, if you had, a region, not a humongous region, but a medium-sized region that wanted to do something like this, the cost of coming in and looking at the areas we've identified here would be in the neighborhood of about $50,000. That's what it would be. Those, when you look at those kinds of studies have been done in the state already, some of them have been far more expensive than that, but that's not the kind of a study I'm talking about. It's a group, whoever they chose to hire, that goes in and takes a look at these areas. I mean, now they may just say, I want one area, so then it's a cheaper price. If you want all four, it's that. But I think all four could be done in the neighborhood of about 50 grand. So, and that, remember, that's generally speaking. There'd be exceptions to that, some smaller, some larger. And so if we had, let's say, four of these that we were going to say we're going to start off with this plan, we'd be at $200,000. So that's what I'm proposing to put on the table is what if we had $200,000 that could fund four or more of these kinds of studies. Tricia.
Jim, has anybody done an analysis of how many places these services have been regionalized already? What's the need?
Yeah,
if we were to say everybody who isn't should be, what would the need be?
Yeah, there's obviously some areas in the state that have done, have consolidated, some in this area, some in this area. Area by mean business or HR or what have you. And then some other places in the state have done just very little. And so I think there's potentially a whole lot of folks out there that might be interested in this. I don't know. There may be none. There may be zero. But from where I'm sitting is, if there's zero, there's zero. We don't want to mandate anybody doing anything. But according to my scenario, if there's more than four groups that are interested in doing this, obviously some team, whether it's this team or some other team, would evaluate those and decide who would receive those particular grants and in what amount. But I know at some point somebody's going to ask, what kind of money are you talking about here? And I'm proposing $200,000.
Let's make it three so we got bargaining room.
And I would certainly support that. Senator Wisnant,
clarification. So it wouldn't work to say if your potential, the cost is X, then your grant's X or something like that. We're better to say four or more because you could approve it. And the next thing is who approves the grants. Are we going to put that in our recommendation?
We have to put it in there. I think four or
like
more. I think four or more is really important.
And maybe even a clarification that, you know, it doesn't have to be 50,000 if it's a smaller.
That's the point.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't put four or more. The reason, four, I mean, when we are talking about the bill, I would talk about the numbers, but most grants don't get through Ways and Means with the full amount that people are asking for. And so I'm just saying.
I said three.
Yes. And so what sometimes happens if there's like a four or more, then it gets so watered down. Like when Ways and Means says, well, here's your 50,000, guys. And it's four or more. Oh, well, here's 10,000. And it kind of becomes, you know.
Okay, I see that.
Yeah.
So what kind of language would you recommend? Fund a limited number or just we will fund
just
grants?
Here. Yeah, it's just here.
Limited number up to 300,000.
We'll fund up to
300,000.
To whatever our budget number is.
Yeah. It's like, okay. Yeah, so then the 300. And then I would say that each of the grants may vary because we've also listed, you know, the four things that we want them to focus on. I could envision that there could be a region who's been very successful in one of these areas already, or views themselves as successful, that wants to focus on another area, maybe that's less expensive. Another region may want to focus on all four.
That's right.
So I could see some variation, and I would rely on the regions to come forth with their plans and their self-identification, you know, about areas they'd want to focus on.
They'd be required to come forward with a budget sheet, and those of us who have experienced this kind of work would be able to see whether those were in line.
I would suggest, okay, who is, I'm going to go back to something we did a decade or so ago, because clearly we're going to do this, and then they're going to make whoever's going to make their application and put it in, and so the allocation will be an e-board function, but I'm wondering if the appropriate clearinghouse for that or the recommendation would be to interim through interim standing committees. A joint committee.
Well, it'd be nice to have a policy committee look at it before the
that's what I'm saying. Have a joint committee look at the applications. And we've done this before in other areas of government. And then the policy committee makes a recommendation to the e-board as to the allocation.
So what you're suggesting is that it's not funded during the session.
Well, how could it be? No, the funding will be in the session. The actual...
Yeah.
It's not going to, you know... It's not going to become reality till after Signe Die when the budget's in and all of that stuff.
Yeah, totally.
So, and at that point, the various groups put their proposals together and, you know, because ledge days are in conjunction with e-board. So, you know, the ledge.
So it could happen.
Yeah, it'd be very easy to have a joint meeting of the House and Senate Ed Committees. And let people come in and make their case, and then we make a recommendation to the e-board, and it's still an e-board decision, but with recommendation. I think that works, don't you, Gene?
I really like that. Yeah,
it's good. Even Devlin's committee on the state school funding distribution is going to go through policy before they make any changes.
Yeah, It helps us get rid of some of the disconnect we've had over time. You know, we do policy, and then it goes somewhere, and something else happens.
But before I agree with you,
okay,
I got to get the frown off Cindy's face. Yeah.
No, the downside with that, and I've seen, and our agency has both models, this particular biennium. We have some that our friends in Ways and Means are probably getting tired of hearing from us on, and there's others that we rolled out.
and I don't think they've heard about them since. Maybe in our budget discussion next time they'll probably hear about them. But in any case, the downside is that it will delay the grant. There's examples of grants getting delayed by as much as a year going through that process. Sometimes what happens too, and just saying, 2016 comes along and maybe the funding gets altered a bit and what was in existence in 2015 no longer is. There's things like that that happens. Because anytime, you know, it goes through the e-board, sometimes the money's there and sometimes it's not. So it's a little bit,
it can always change.
So there's a delay and there's a risk.
But our task force's recommendation is $300,000 be set aside that the interim policies review of any grants be passed on to e-board to utilize this money.
Let me tell you how I envision this working. And this is what we did this a long time ago with salmon recovery. This was before we had legislative days, committees met, but we knew when the e-board was meeting. And all the watershed councils and everybody were coming in with their recommendations. And so we set it up to where a joint committee reviewed all those a day or two before the e-board met when they were going to make the allocation. And so we could give them a prioritized list of what we thought to help inform the allocation that they were already scheduled to make. So from that perspective, it doesn't have to be a delay.
And what I mean by a delay is that, let me be more specific.
Sure.
So some of the first grants we rolled out were in like August after the session ended in July, and then September. We had a number that rolled out before the beginning of the school year. I mean, it was very important to get that money out the door. The first legislative days are, Richard?
September.
But at that point, there probably wouldn't be responses back. So we're probably looking at December, I would think. Yeah. So it's like the 6 months out.
Wouldn't go into effect till the next school year anyway. Yeah. So I mean, you're not going to get it
These aren't funds for implementation. Yeah, these are funds for planning. Yeah, that's a whole different critter.
Yeah.
So, but I think it allows, you know, I mean, it's not just these entities coming in and making their presentation. It's also the departments weighing in on their view of it and whoever. So we, you know, the whole thing is we're shining a bright light on the process, which would probably help the process too.
Now, are you going to submit this as a committee? How are we going to get this started? I mean, the deadline's already over for us to submit things.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee is not is not allowed to submit legislation, but is required to submit a report. Mm-hmm. And so, as the committee moves forward thinking about what is produced, it would be helpful to, for example, me and the committee staff to keep kind of the buckets clear and what you want to put. I mean, we can phrase things differently in terms of Senator Cruz's or Representative Nathanson's legislation. That can be worked in. They can overlap, but this committee does a report. Legislation comes from somewhere else.
But I would be willing to bet that what we've come up with here, what we're talking about, this report turned into legislation, I don't think we'd have any trouble convincing Senator Haas to make it a committee bill, do you?
Committee staff has no opinion, Senator.
Okay. I will make that assumption.
I think you're right.
Yeah, no. I mean, this is expected and pre-session filed. You know, it's like some stuff that Modus Anderson and I are working on that we didn't pre-session file, but guess what? It's going to come to our committee and we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it doesn't happen until January, we're still going to do it.
And as Representative Wisnett pointed out, our report will have the recommendation in there that this ought to move forward legislatively.
But this should be relatively easy to put in LC language, I would think. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to, with Cindy's help, it'll be 99% there already.
So I think we're good.
I think we're good, too.
We're okay.
Yeah.
Good job.
Anything else from any other members of the committee? And what I see the next agenda being on, what did we say, the 29th? 28th. Is that we will bring forward the new revised language here, and we'll discuss it as a group and
formally approve as a task force.
Will we be seeing drafts of our report language?
Sure. when's our report due?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's due no later than November 20th.
Right, so I think we need to have a draft of report language for the 28th.
Yeah, so some of you and I will work on that.
Okay.
Okay, anything further for today? Meeting adjourned. Thank you all. Good meeting. Thank you all. Good meeting. Meeting adjourned.